This is Emergency Medicine Cases, EM Quick Hits Podcast, and I'm your host, Dr. Anton Hellman.
EM Cases is brought to you by SHREMI, the Schwartz-Reisman Emergency Medicine Institute. That's a nonprofit organization dedicated to improving EM care through high-quality research and education.
The opinions expressed on this podcast are intended for general information and educational purposes only and should not be used to diagnose, treat, or prevent any medical condition, nor should they be used as a substitute for medical advice from a qualified practicing physician. Unless stated otherwise, the opinions expressed by the hosts or guests are made in their individual capacity, not on behalf of the Institute nor Medicine Cases.
First, a word from our sponsor, Metricade, the experts in complex physician scheduling since 2012. I've been using Metricade's incredible scheduling system for a decade, and it's been a game changer for me and my colleagues. Shift work comes with its challenges, but Metricade helps minimize the drawbacks by ensuring a fair distribution of shifts while integrating circadian-friendly rhythm recovery time into its methodology. Less sleep deprivation means I can be a better EM doc on shift and still have energy for life outside the hospital. Check out metricade.com/emcases to make your schedule fair and improve your sleep.
This episode is brought to you by Easy Recess, the resuscitation assistant. This amazing app has drug dosing, equipment size calculation, treatment algorithms, all in under 3 clicks. Rapid access to life-saving critical info in a user-friendly interface. Try the app for free with the promo code EMCases or visit easyrecess.com/emcases. That's ezrecess.com/EMCASES.
First up, we have Dr. Matthew MacArthur, who's going to tell us a little bit about occipital nerve blocks, who to do them on, how to do them, why to do them. Here he goes.
Recently, I had a patient come into the ED with occipital neuralgia. The patient was a female in her 40s, not on any regular medications, who presented with 3 days of frequent, sharp stabbing pains, originating from her left occiput and shooting up the scalp and behind the ear, with associated allodynia and pain with brushing her hair on that side of the head. She also had concurrent viral RTI symptoms with fever, aches and pains, cough, and sore throat in the middle of a winter influenza season. The patient endorsed a previous history of occipital neuralgia, and her last bad flare-up was a few years ago when she had COVID, which felt very similar to her current presentation. And at that time, the headaches did eventually settle on their own after about a week. She had tried numerous pain medications, including some Tylenol number 3s and Ketorolac that had been prescribed previously for a different issue, with no relief, and told me she had essentially not slept in 3 days due to the pain. The patient was febrile with a temperature of 39.1 degrees at triage, and the rest of her vitals were unremarkable. On exam, there was no neck stiffness or rash. Screening neuro exam was normal, including hearing, gait, cranial nerves, and coordination. Basic ED blood work was normal. She did have reproducibility of her symptoms with percussion over the left occiput. With a clinical diagnosis of occipital neuralgia, I could have offered this patient neuropathic medications like gabapentinoids or TCAs, but these medications are not always effective and they have a significant side effect profile. I drew up 3 cc's of 2% lidocaine and performed a left occipital nerve block. Within 3 minutes, the patient was completely pain-free and able to be discharged shortly thereafter with appropriate follow-up and return to ED instructions. Before I tell you how to do an occipital nerve block, let's talk about the indications. The most obvious indication would be for cases like the one I just presented, where you suspect the diagnosis of occipital neuralgia based on a recurrent, sharp stabbing headache in the distribution of the occipital nerve, with associated allodynia or dysesthesia and tenderness to percussion of the nerve. In fact, according to the International Classification of Headache Disorders, one of the diagnostic criteria for occipital neuralgia is relief of symptoms by local anesthetic nerve block. So this procedure is both diagnostic and therapeutic for these patients. But occipital nerve blocks can be a part of our treatment armamentarium for other occipital headaches as well, including occipital migraine, cervicogenic headache, and cluster headache. There's a systematic review in 2023 published in the Journal of Anesthesiology and Clinical Pharmacology that found immediate and sustained reductions in occipital headache pain scores at 5 to 20 minutes, 1 to 6 weeks, and 12 to 24 weeks post-injection. However, the evidence is mostly limited to small studies. Personally, my go-to treatment cocktail for most moderate to severe migraine patients in the ED is 10 milligrams of metoclopramide, 10 milligrams of ketorolac, and if they've been vomiting or had decreased fluid intake, 1 liter fluid bolus, all intravenously. And I found it's very effective for most patients. I'll often add in 4 milligrams of dexamethasone to reduce the risk of headache recurrence. For migraine patients who fail this initial treatment and whose headache is predominantly occipital rather than frontal, I will offer the occipital nerve block as a second-line treatment. If they have a bilateral occipital migraine, I'd do a bilateral block, and if it's unilateral, I'd do a unilateral block. So now that we've talked indications, how do you do the block? The basic gist of it is that you're injecting local anesthetic at the back of the head to anesthetize the greater occipital nerve. This block should only take 1 to 2 minutes to perform. In terms of medication, I use 3 cc's of 2% lidocaine. Some clinicians add a steroid like 4 milligrams of dexamethasone, and some clinicians will use longer-acting local anesthetics like bupivacaine, but there's no strong evidence that one approach is better than the other, and even a short-acting anesthetic like lidocaine can abort the headache with sustained effect. Next, we landmark the injection site. The easiest way to do this is by palpation. If you're not driving, try palpating the landmarks on yourself. First, palpate the occipital protuberance, which is the most posterior bony prominence at the back of your skull on the midline. Next, palpate the mastoid process, which is the bony prominence behind your ear. Now, if you trace an imaginary line from the occipital protuberance to the mastoid process, that corresponds to the superior nuchal line of the occipital bone. You want to be always injecting on or just above the superior nuchal line. Along this line, your greater occipital nerve will lie roughly 1/3 of the way to the mastoid process, and your lesser occipital nerve will lie roughly 2/3 of the way to the mastoid process. You can choose to inject either a greater occipital nerve alone or greater and lesser occipital nerve block. Instead of using the 1/3 rule, an alternate way of landmarking would be to use either palpation or ultrasound to identify the occipital artery along this line, and choose your injection site just medial to the artery, as the greater occipital nerve tends to run medial to the artery. You could also simply percuss their skull along this superior nuchal line and inject at the spot that most strongly reproduces their symptoms, essentially doing a Tinel test to locate the nerve. For injection, use a small gauge, such as 27 or 25 gauge needle. Advance the needle directly perpendicular to skin until you hit the periosteum of the skull. Next, withdraw your needle just a tiny amount to come off the periosteum, aspirate to check that you're not in a vessel, and slowly inject your lidocaine. You should rotate or fan the needle as you inject to attempt to spread out the anesthetic into a broader area. Some clinicians will do a single injection at the landmark location of the nerve. However, my approach would be to do 3 1 cc injections of lidocaine, 1 over the landmark location of the nerve, 1 injection 1 centimeter lateral to this location, and 1 injection 1 centimeter medial to this location. That should maximize your chance of hitting the nerve with your anesthetic. The critical part here is that you want to make sure you are above the superior nuchal line I've described, and that you can clearly palpate skull wherever you intend to advance your needle. Your goal is simply to advance the needle down until you hit the skull. As long as you palpate the skull correctly, as I've described, this is an extremely safe procedure with minimal risk of complications, equivalent to any other local infiltration of anesthetic. The only way you could really do major harm is if your needle somehow ends up missing the skull completely and going in and around the spinal column or foramen magnum, which could only happen if you totally screw up your landmarking, for instance by going way too inferior or medial. So make sure you're confident that you're able to palpate the landmarks and confidently feel the skull along the superior nuchal line. If you can't do that, don't attempt this nerve block. After your injection, the anesthetic will spread along the tissue plane and surround the greater occipital nerve. Just like a ring block of the finger, this is a very forgiving block. One single injection can settle down the dysregulated pain signaling and provide sustained headache relief even after the anesthetic wears off. So there's your quick review of how to perform an occipital nerve block. This procedure only takes about 1 minute to perform. It's safe, and it can be a great part of your treatment armamentarium, not just for occipital neuralgia, where it's a no-brainer, but for any occipital headache that is refractory to first-line treatment, such as occipital migraine. Don't forget to consider the dangerous diagnoses and obtain further testing if indicated to rule out badness. So there you have it. There are few things in our line of work that are more satisfying than being able to perform a quick and easy procedure that immediately makes our patients feel better and relieves their suffering. Hopefully this empowers you to consider this safe, quick, and easy nerve block when it's indicated.
Thanks so much, Dr. MacArthur. We'll have some good visuals in the show notes to help you solidify this easy procedure in your huge brains. Okay, our last two-part main episode podcast was on the management of intermediate and high-risk PE. And we mentioned POCUS a few times, but we didn't do a deep dive, which I think is warranted. So as part of our Best of University of Toronto EM series, I asked Dr. Ian Chernoff from Sana Health Sciences to give us his take on the utility of POCUS in the management of sick PE patients. And now for the Best of University of Toronto Emergency Medicine.
PE is a dream topic for a POCUS geek, as there's so much POCUS that's potentially relevant in PE. But I'm going to restrain myself and keep this focused, evidence-based, and practical. The good news is that all of the basic echo views have their own findings that support the diagnosis of RV strain in PE. IVC distension on the subcostal, the D sign on the parasternal long axis, and evidence of RV enlargement on the parasternal long. But the apical four chamber is going to be the view that generates the most useful information in PE. RV failure plays a major role in the mortality caused by PE, and finding signs of RV failure with POCUS can identify patients at increased risk of death. Identifying RV dysfunction in intermediate risk patients provides vital prognostic information about the level of peril the PE is posing to them, and may well alter their disposition and potentially push them towards more aggressive treatment. And in high risk and undifferentiated crashing patients, POCUS can allow you to diagnose with high levels of confidence that the cause of the patient's deterioration is a PE. This may be information that is simply not accessible in any other way in a patient that is too unstable to make it to the CT, and an ability to figure this out with POCUS might well be life-saving for the patient. Although POCUS is invaluable with PE, unfortunately, no single echo parameter reliably identifies RV dysfunction in every patient in a standalone way. PE is all about heterogeneity, and that theme also holds for the POCUS findings that can be anticipated in PE. I want to describe how the RV contracts and try to have an image in your head of the RV as you'd see it on an apical four-chamber view as I do so. The RV contracts both longitudinally, with its base moving towards its apex, and radially, with the free wall of the RV moving towards the interventricular septum like a bellows. The longitudinal function of the RV can be evaluated by TAPSE, an acronym for tricuspid annular plane systolic excursion. To measure TAPSE, M mode is placed through the lateral tricuspid annulus, and so doing, the movement of the base of the RV towards the apex can be quantified. TAPSE is to the RV as EPSS, or septal slap, is to evaluating LV function. The most commonly used cutoff for TAPSE is 1.6 centimeters, with a TAPSE of less than 1.6 centimeters being consistent with RV dysfunction. Radial dysfunction of the RV, on the other hand, will manifest with hypokinesis of the free wall of the RV. That is to say, there will be decreased movement of the free wall of the RV into the right ventricular cavity and towards the septum. Radial dysfunction of the RV is thought to be more sensitive to raised RV afterload than longitudinal dysfunction is, which is part of the reason that TAPSE isn't always enough on its own to evaluate for RV dysfunction and PE. The echo parameters found to be most predictive of bad outcomes in patients with PE were RV hypokinesis, abnormal TAPSE, and an increased RV to LV ratio on apical four-chamber view. The normal ratio of the RV to the LV chamber is about two-thirds measured across the tips of the tricuspid and mitral valves. With RV dysfunction, the RV will be the same size or larger than the LV on the apical four-chamber view. So I think a good basic yet comprehensive approach to looking for RV dysfunction in PE would be just that. Measure TAPSE, check the RV to LV ratio, and look for hypokinesis of the free wall of the RV, all in the apical four-chamber view. Next, I want to discuss some of the more specific PE signs and highlight where they may have particular value. Paradoxical septal motion refers to the intraventricular septum bowing into the LV, as best seen on the apical four-chamber view. McConnell's sign is hypokinesis of the free wall of the RV, but with apical sparing, that is, preserved apical contraction of the RV. It's only found about one quarter of the time in PE, but is very specific for PE when you see it, with specificities of 97 to 99% in systematic reviews and meta-analyses. Importantly, McConnell's sign is one of the POCUS findings that can help to differentiate acute PE from chronic RV pathologies such as pulmonary hypertension. A caveat is that McConnell's sign can also sometimes be seen in RV infarction, but fortunately, there's considerable confluence as to how crashing patients with RV infarction and high-risk PEs would be managed. Seeing an actual clot in transit through the RV or RA is rare and spectacularly horrifying, but essentially confirms the diagnosis of PE. Perhaps conspicuously absent in my discussion so far has been any mention of the IVC. Despite its limitations, I love the IVC, specifically for its value in helping to phenotype on differentiated shock. As with many, the framework that I've carried around with me for years with the IVC and PE is that if my patient is crashing from a big PE, they will have evidence both of RV dysfunction on echo and they will have a distended IVC. In preparing for this podcast, I was surprised to see how little specific evidence there seems to be for reliably finding IV distension in PE. Most of the critical reviews and meta-analyses examining the performance of the various echo PE signs didn't even include analysis of the IVC, and those that did suggested that it doesn't actually perform that well. I love the IVC, but as much as it pains me to admit it, as I kind of feel like I'm ratting out my best friend, nowhere was I able to find evidence to substantiate my previously held belief that the IVC will almost always be distended in patients with significant right ventricular dysfunction from PE. So now I want to try to put this all together into a practical approach to how and why POCUS can improve the care we deliver to patients with intermediate and high-risk PEs. Starting with intermediate-risk PE patients, if I already know their biomarkers are elevated and I can potentially identify their RV dilatation on CT, does it actually add anything prognostically to look at their RVs with POCUS, or is it just a waste of time? A 2016 study compared the ability of CT versus echo to identify right ventricular dysfunction in PE in intermediate high-risk patients. This study demonstrated that adding echo improved the detection of patients with RV dysfunction compared to the use of CT alone. So I think doing POCUS in intermediate-risk patients is worth the time that it takes. And in high-risk patients, the test characteristics of POCUS are fabulous. If the cause of the patient's shock or peri-arrest state is PE, then the likelihood of POCUS revealing this diagnosis is exceedingly high. A 2017 Italian ED study looked at people in shock from a suspected PE and explored how accurate a focused cardiac and venous bedside ultrasound protocol was in demonstrating their cause of shock was PE. The protocol was very basic. They looked for either an increased RV to LV ratio or RV dilatation in the heart, plus did bedside limited compression ultrasonography of the legs looking for DVT. Cardiac ultrasound alone had a sensitivity of 91% and a specificity of 87%, and leg ultrasound alone was 56% sensitive but 95% specific in diagnosing PE as the cause of shock. If either cardiac or leg ultrasound was positive, the sensitivity rose to 95%, and if both cardiac and leg ultrasound were positive, this was 100% specific in diagnosing PE as the cause of shock. 100% specific. The most recent guidelines from the European Society of Cardiology also support that, quote, in a highly unstable patient, echocardiographic evidence of RF dysfunction is sufficient to prompt immediate reperfusion without further testing, end quote. So there are guidelines to back you up if you decide to lace a patient who is peri-arrest from a PE based on POCUS findings and too sick to make it to CT. Lysing a patient dying from a PE without a CT being done beforehand is something that I've done exactly once in my entire career. The patient had lots of evidence of RV dysfunction on echo, including McConnell sign, plus a very proximal femoral DVT. But despite my level of confidence that I knew what I was dealing with, it still felt like a big leap to pull the trigger and give lytics. This is not going to be an everyday occurrence, but it might be an intervention that can save a life. Unfortunately, my patient had a very good outcome. However, there are also some huge pitfalls to be aware of with POCUS and PE. First off, it's surprisingly easy to make the RV artifactually look bigger on apical four-chamber than it actually is. If your probe isn't placed at the true apex of the LV, this is called foreshortening. And foreshortening can easily distort the appearance of both ventricles. On an apical four-chamber view that is not foreshortened, the LV should look elliptical or bullet-shaped. But if the LV does not look bullet-shaped and the entire heart seems rounder and broader, then your apical four-chamber view may be foreshortened. The corrective action is generally to move the probe in interspace lower and slightly more lateral. The second pitfall to consider is whether the RV dysfunction that I think I might be seeing with POCUS is consistent with the rest of the clinical picture. POCUS is only one data point to be used amongst many in evaluating patients with PE. And if, for instance, the clot burden on CT is low, but on POCUS the RV seems enlarged, then that doesn't add up. And to be swayed too much by POCUS findings if they're incongruous with the rest of the picture, especially if they are prompting you to consider more aggressive care, like pulling the trigger on lysing a patient, I think would be rash and the wrong thing to do. Which brings me to the third pitfall, which is the need to distinguish acute from chronic RV dysfunction. There are simpler ways to do this, such as looking for thickening of the RV free wall of greater than 5 millimeters on the subcostal or parasternal long axis views, which would point towards chronic RV dysfunction rather than acute. I already mentioned McConnell sign, which when found points towards an acute cause. Or if you actually see a clot in transit, then you know you're definitely looking at something acute. But distinguishing acute from chronic RV dysfunction is also where the more advanced POCUS applications come into play, and I want to mention these briefly. There are essentially two echo parameters that are incorporated into these fancier applications. First, examining flow mechanics through the pulmonic valve with pulse wave Doppler, which is typically done on a parasternal short axis view at the RV inflow outflow level. And second, quantifying the degree of tricuspid regurgitation with color and continuous wave Doppler, which could be done on multiple views, including the apical four chamber view. When looking at pulse wave Doppler flow through the pulmonic valve, there are two findings that can aid in differentiating acute RV dysfunction from PE from chronic. First, as the right ventricle has limited capacity to abruptly accommodate to the rapid increase in RV afterload produced by proximal PE, the velocity with which blood flows into the pulmonary artery peaks very rapidly within 60 milliseconds. And this is called the pulmonary artery acceleration time. Keep this number in mind as it's one of the two 60s that make up the 60-60 rule, and I'll explain the other 60 of the 60-60 rule shortly. In contrast with chronic RV pathology like pulmonary hypertension, the RV is at a period of time to hypertrophy and acclimatize to the increased resistance, and blood flow into the pulmonary artery takes longer to reach peak velocity. Second, if there is a proximal obstruction in the pulmonary artery from a large central PE, that produces an early retrograde pressure wave as blood tries to flow into the pulmonary artery but strikes this obstruction. This produces a characteristic notch in the pulse wave Doppler tracing called early systolic notching. In contrast, pulmonary hypertension or a lower risk, more distally located PE will lead to this rebound back pressure wave arriving in a more delayed fashion and cause the notch on the pulse wave Doppler tracing to occur later in RV systole, which is known as mid-systolic notching. Tricuspid regurgitation is also a very common finding with RV dilatation that occurs with large PEs. What distinguishes the TR of acute PE from that of a chronic process are the peak velocities and resultant pressure gradients that can be produced by each. With something like pulmonary hypertension, the RV has had time to adapt and hypertrophy and could produce higher peak TR velocities and pressure gradients than a previously normal thin-walled RV can muster against the sudden calamitous increase in RV afterload, such as would be produced by a large proximal PE. Whereas chronic RV dysfunction can produce higher TR gradients, the tricuspid regurg produced from PE would not be expected to produce peak gradients greater than 60 millimeters of mercury, which is the second 60 of the 60-60 rule. So if there's an acute cause of the RV dysfunction like a PE, it would be expected to produce a pulmonary artery acceleration time that peaks within 60 milliseconds and TR peak gradients that do not exceed 60 millimeters of mercury, which are the two 60s that make up the 60-60 rule. For an ER doc, I think it's a huge long shot that a decision to lyse a patient is ever likely to hinge on an ability to do the 60-60 rule or recognize early systolic notching. It's interesting stuff to learn about, but mastering these advanced applications isn't where I think the emphasis should be for POCUS, for PE, and the ED. Getting good at the apical four-chamber view and becoming comfortable with the simpler stuff that I mentioned earlier. Is the RV bigger than the LV? Is there RV hypokinesis? Measuring TAPSE is going to be far more impactful for all of us. So to sum up, even though there are about a million things you can do with POCUS and PE, the evidence suggests you can keep it efficient and simple, and this is where the highest yield is. Ideally, try to assess the RV on multiple views and simply compare the size of the RV to that of the LV. Look for RV hypokinesis and measure TAPSE. And particularly in patients who are crashing, for whom you need to come up with a game plan right away, also the focus of their legs to look for DVT. The IVC remains of value in phenotyping on differentiated shock, but a non-plethoric IVC doesn't exclude the possibility that a PE is still causing significant RV dysfunction. In intermediate risk patients, POCUS helps to pick out those from the pile who are highest risk of bad outcomes and may be candidates for more aggressive therapy. And in patients who are crashing or peri-arrest, POCUS becomes indispensable. It can accurately distinguish which of those undifferentiated patients have PE as the culprit, and POCUS findings alone are sufficient to justify lysing PE patients who are dying in front of you and might allow you to potentially save a life.
Do you dread doing your clinical notes every shift? Do you feel like you can never get ahead of charting? If you're shaking your head yes, keep listening. Freed is an AI scribe that listens, transcribes, and writes medical documentation for you. Notes are written in your style and ready the moment the patient encounter is over. Just imagine leaving work at the same time as your last patient. Freed is HIPAA compliant, secure, and takes less than 30 seconds to learn. Artificial intelligence can't replace you, but it can do the administrative work that no human should be subjected to. All the magic happens in just a few clicks so that you can spend less energy on charting and more time on doing what you do best. Freed learns your style over time, just like a human scribe, and it'll never quit on you. More than 6,000 of your clinician colleagues already use Freed AI. Get back to spending your clinical time caring for patients and let Freed AI do the rest. Head over to getfreed.ai and use the code EMC50 to receive $50 off your first month with Freed. That's getfreed.ai with the code EMC50. All right. Thanks so much, Dr. Chernoff, for your insights into POCUS for PE. Next up, we have Hans Rosenberg, who's going to tell us about a condition that I have to admit I don't have a great handle on, and that is myelopathy, i.e. spinal cord badness. And that's because the presentation of all these spinal cord lesions can be quite subtle and have a variety of neurologic patterns, which I can never remember. I like to simplify it and think of spinal cord badness when there's bilateral weakness or numbness, or both, at a specific sensory level, plus signs of upper motor neuron dysfunction like hyperreflexia or positive Babinski's or bowel or bladder dysfunction. And if you combine these two with no brain dysfunction, so no cranial nerve issues, no confusion, no aphasia, then you're probably dealing with a spinal cord lesion. Then I just go through the usual differential list of trauma versus vascular versus infectious versus neoplastic versus inflammatory, etc. All right, let's see what Dr. Rosenberg has to say about myelopathy.
Today, we're diving into myelopathy, focusing on rapid identification, key diagnostic steps, and high-yield management strategies based on the article, Just the Facts, Emergency Department Approach to Myelopathy by Dr. Zach McDonald. So let's start with a clinical scenario. An 80-year-old male with progressive lower extremity weakness, gait instability, recurrent falls, and bilateral hand numbness presents after multiple ED visits without a diagnosis. He is hemodynamically stable but unable to ambulate safely. Does this sound familiar? The challenge here is recognizing the subtle but critical signs of myelopathy early to prevent long-term morbidity. So how do we recognize myelopathy? Well, first, let's define it to make sure we are all on the same page. Myelopathy refers to spinal cord dysfunction, which impairs signal transmission between the brain and the body. It can result from various etiologies, broadly categorized into compressive and non-compressive causes. For compressive myelopathy, we're going to think mainly about degenerative cervical myelopathy, especially in the elderly, but also you want to consider central cord syndrome post a fall, epidural abscess, tumors, or vascular malformations. For non-compressive myelopathy, the differential includes myelitis, which can be either infectious, inflammatory, or autoimmune, vitamin B12 deficiency, toxins, radiation, and paraneoplastic syndromes. So what are the key clinical features that are going to help you recognize upper motor neuron involvement? Well, you want to look for hyperreflexia, so you're going to see increased deep tendon reflexes in the affected extremities, clonus, which would present as rhythmic involuntary muscle contractions, a Babinski sign, so upgoing plantar reflex, changes in gait, especially patients may be observed to have spasticity and difficulty with tandem walking, autonomic dysfunction, which most of us are familiar with, such as bladder retention or bowel incontinence, which can indicate significant cord involvement. A new sign that I was introduced to in this article was Hoffman sign. The Hoffman sign, demonstrated by flicking the middle finger's nail to observe quick adduction of the thumb and index finger, indicates upper motor neuron dysfunction, particularly in the cervical spine. So now that we've performed a history and physical exam on the patient, what's the diagnostic workup in the emergency department? Well, the gold standard is to start with an MRI. If there's high suspicion for a cervical injury, then getting a cervical MRI will be important. However, if you're considering multifocal disease, for example, in the context of an epidural abscess or transverse myelitis, then a whole spine MRI is suggested. Lumbar puncture may also play a role if no compressive lesion is found, as LP can help diagnose inflammatory and infectious causes. The management in the emergency department once a myelopathy is suspected is as follows. If there's spinal cord compression, emergent neurosurgical consultation will be required, dexamethasone for a malignant compression, and broad-spectrum antibiotics if an epidural abscess is suspected. If a non-compressive etiology is suspected, then immediate neurology consultation should be sought. Furthermore, and this would be in consultation with the neurologist likely, but immunotherapy may be started, such as steroids or plasmapheresis, for certain autoimmune conditions. Finally, for disposition of these patients, you really want to keep in mind that rapidly progressive symptoms necessitate urgent imaging and referral to centers that would have neurosurgical and neurology consultation available. Stable patients with mild progressive symptoms may be candidates for outpatient workup. However, keep in mind that delayed diagnosis risk irreversible deficits. So let's go back to our case. Let's say this patient also had a positive Hoffman sign, and as such, underwent a cervical MRI. This revealed severe C5 and C6 cord compression. He was transferred to a center that could perform decompressive surgery, and several months later, you find out that the patient actually shows significant neurological improvement. Now for the take-home points. One, upper motor neuron signs, such as Hoffman's, Babinski, and hyperreflexia, should raise suspicion for myelopathy. Two, MRI is the key diagnostic tool. Keep in mind that whole spine imaging may be required. And three, rapid recognition and referral to neurosurgery or neurology are critical for preventing permanent disability. That's it for today's episode. Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much, Dr. Rosenberg. Next up, we have a new voice to EM cases, Dr. Sean Segarin. He's an EM doc and founder of Dynamic Simulation, an outfit that travels around Ontario doing simulation-based teaching. He's going to share some insights into team dynamics in resuscitation.
When we talk about resuscitation, the focus is usually on the airway, the meds, the procedures, and who is running the room. But after years of running high acuity simulation in hospitals where teams are small, stretched thin, and often managing critical patients without much backup, I have realized something. The most important person in the room might be the one sitting quietly at the back, the recorder. Sometimes it's a junior nurse. Sometimes it's the most experienced clinician on shift. But they're often the only one in the room who isn't locked into a single task, and that makes them essential. We ran a sim recently. Crashing patient, mixed shock picture, unstable airway, a lot happening all at once. And what stood out wasn't who intubated or when the pressor started. It was the nurse in the corner calmly charting, but also tracking the whole picture. They were the ones saying things like, pressure's been in the 80 systolic for 6 minutes. Do we want to reassess? Ketamine went in a minute ago, but I didn't hear rocuronium. Not dramatic, not loud, but exactly the kind of signal a team needs when the noise starts building. While the rest of us are focused on lines and tubes and meds and compressions, the recorder often becomes the only person with bandwidth to notice what's changing or not changing. Especially in places where there's no trauma team, there's no second doc, no RT, awareness starts to narrow quickly. And that voice in the back, it becomes the anchor. I have seen this over and over in sim. It's the recorder who spots the rhythm change. It's the recorder who notices the end-tidal CO2 have dropped. It's the recorder who says we've given 3 boluses, what has actually improved? That role, the one that often gets overlooked, is what I like to call the situational awareness seat. In debriefs, I'll ask, what helped you all stay grounded? More often than not, the answer is the person keeping track. So here's my ask, especially if you're leading a team. Make space for that role. Don't gloss over it. Mid-resus, take a second and ask, is there anything that you're seeing that I might be missing? Because the recorder isn't just documenting. They are the pulse check on the plan. They are the memory of the case, and they are the one that is watching the forest while the rest of us are in the trees. In a high-stakes environment, that might be the most important perspective in the room. And when we treat it that way, the whole team gets better.
And now a word from one of our sponsors, Easy Resus, the resuscitation assistant. Easy Resus is thrilled to announce that they are now available for institutional access. In addition to providing the app for all employees in your organization, this means access to exclusive features like printable protocols with calculated medication doses, customizable content to fit your local protocols and practices, access to Easy Resus on computers via the web-based version, and much, much more. To learn more, visit the institutional license section at easyresus.com. And as always, you can download Easy Resus and use the promo code EMCASES, that's EMCASES, one word, to get your 2-month free trial on an individual subscription.
What do you do with a patient with incidental neutropenia who does not have a fever? Do they need antibiotics? Do they need to be admitted? Who needs hematology referral? We're going to cover all this and more in today's Quick Hits episode. Let's start with the definition. That's based on the absolute neutrophil counts, or the ANC. The normal ANC for adults is anywhere between 1,500 to 7,000, but this depends on age, other medical issues, and the patient ethnicity. Any ANC less than 1,500 cells per microliter is considered neutropenic in adults. Mild is between 1,000 to 1,500, moderate is between 500 to 1,000, and severe is less than 500. It's challenging to pin down exact numbers for how often this occurs. The prevalence ranges anywhere between 0 to 25% in healthy, asymptomatic individuals, but this is going to depend on the patient population, their age, and other conditions like autoimmune disorders. Other than the degree of neutropenia, the second way neutropenia is classified is the cause. I'm going to walk through several of the major causes, but for the most part, I keep this simple. Malignant versus non-malignant. So first is malignancy. It's more common a hematologic malignancy like leukemias and myelodysplastic syndromes. The second major etiology is non-malignant. Overall, the most common causes of mild neutropenia in adults are Duffy null-associated neutrophil count, dose-dependent drug-induced neutropenia that we more commonly see with cytotoxic agents, and then finally infections, which are usually viral. Duffy null-associated neutrophil count is an inherited cause with mild or moderate neutropenia. Thankfully, this is not associated with increased risk of infection, and these patients typically appear well overall. Familial neutropenia and congenital neutropenia are other inherited causes. Next, under non-malignant, is a medication. This is typically dose-dependent. The most common are cytotoxic or immunosuppressive medications, but there are many others, like anti-inflammatory drugs, even NSAIDs, antithyroid medications, antibiotics, antivirals, antifungals and antimalarial drugs, psychotropic medications, anti-epileptics, cardiovascular drugs and diuretics, sulfonylureas, and then dermatologic medications. We'll have a list for you in the show notes. The third one is infection. Viral infections like EBV, HIV, hepatitis, bacterial infections, even parasitic and rickettsial infections can cause neutropenia, but it's typically mild. The next ones are less common. Nutritional deficiencies like B12, folate, and copper can cause neutropenia, but it's often associated with anemia. Think about this in patients with long-term veganism, inflammatory bowel disease, post-bariatric surgery patients, and those with alcohol use disorder. Rheumatologic and autoimmune disorders can cause neutropenia, and then there's aplastic anemia, and then chronic idiopathic neutropenia and cyclic neutropenia. So with all of that, what's the approach to the patient with incidental neutropenia? There are a couple key components here. First is the clinical status of the patient and the suspected cause based on your history and exam. Second, all comes down to the labs. You need to check the CBC and peripheral smear and ask, what is their ANC? What does the differential look like? Are there other cell lines affected? And what does the peripheral smear look like? If the patient is critically ill, they're unstable, or they're febrile, that's an emergency. They need blood cultures, antibiotics, and admission. For these patients, also check a coag panel, LDH, fibrinogen, and renal function. not only do you need to think about neutropenic fever and sepsis, but also TTP and DIC. Otherwise, your history and exam are essential to look for the cause and other life-threatening issues. I'm going to run through some of the key questions, but we'll have another list in the show notes for you. First, has this happened before? Second, is this due to a drug? If it is and they look well, the drug will probably need to be discontinued, but the patient can be discharged as long as it's not severe neutropenia. It's the same if it's happened before and they look well. If this is new and it's not due to a drug, you need to do a deeper dive. Do they have an active infection or other inflammatory issue? Do they have weight loss, chills or fevers, night sweats? Do they have a history of cancer, a GI disorder or liver disease? Have they been experiencing cyclic infections or aphthous ulcers? That suggests cyclic neutropenia. Do they have any special diet issues or chronic alcohol use? Any other substances that could have been modified with levemisole? Do they have a family history of neutropenia or hematologic issues? On exam, of course, first is their hemodynamic status, but take a look at their oral mucosa and skin. Do they have ulcers or jaundice or some other rash? Do they have lymphadenopathy, any joint swelling or bone pain, neurologic or psychiatric changes? Do they have premature graying of the hair or skeletal or fingernail abnormalities? These last findings, combined with a family history of neutropenia or unexplained childhood deaths, is concerning for congenital neutropenia. Next are the labs. If it's possible, see if you can compare it to prior results. But if the patient has an ANC less than 500, particularly if it's less than 200, they have pancytopenia, or if they have leukemic blasts or schistocytes, that patient needs a more urgent evaluation by hematology and potentially admission. An ANC less than 500 is most commonly going to be due to medications. Sepsis and viral infections can cause isolated neutropenia, but it's typically transient and not severe. Anemia can be associated with neutropenia in the setting of nutritional deficiencies like B12 or folate. That's going to give you a macrocytic anemia. The neutropenia for these patients is typically mild, and it will correct with dietary changes. If they don't have severe neutropenia, they're asymptomatic, and they have no worrisome findings on the smear, they don't need admission or even hematology referral up front. But they do need follow-up within a couple weeks for a repeat CBC. Other testing can include viral panels, a liver panel, B12, folate, and copper levels, inflammatory markers for rheumatologic disorders, and then blood typing. You can order these if the primary care provider can follow them up in the system, but otherwise, leave this to the primary provider for ordering. Now, if the primary provider has completed their evaluation with these labs, they haven't determined the cause, and they have continued neutropenia, at that point, hematology referral for evaluation is likely necessary. In summary, incidental neutropenia is probably more common than you might think. The approach includes, first, the clinical status of the patient and the suspected cause based on your history and exam. Second, all comes down to the labs with the CBC and the ANC, the differential, and the peripheral smear. If they're sick, they have severe neutropenia, or concerning findings on the smear, they likely need admission with hematology consultation. Otherwise, most patients can be discharged with follow-up for repeat testing.
Thanks so much, Dr. Long. That answers so many questions I had about neutropenia. Next up is all about what we can do when we feel a need to reach out to another EM doc for advice, but we work, say, in a smaller hospital where we're the only doc on, or we work at a bigger hospital and it's 4 a.m. and we're the only doc on. All right. Dr. Kylie Booth is an emergency physician at Collingwood General and Marine Hospital, the ED lead for Central Region Ontario Health, and most pertinent to this quick hit, the medical director of the Ontario Health Peer-to-Peer Program. You may have seen her give one of her brilliant talks at EMU, and once upon a time, Dr. Booth and I both worked at North York General Hospital ED, where I work currently. Thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Booth.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so let's just start with, what the heck is the Ontario Health Peer-to-Peer Program?
The Ontario Health Peer-to-Peer Program is joy for me as an individual, for our system and for our profession. I think it's practice changing. I think it's paradigm shifting. Essentially, in a nutshell, what peer-to-peer program is an access point to a trusted colleague 24/7. So with one number in Ontario, you can call, and within one or two rings, on the other end of the phone, you can access a peer, a colleague, to run a clinical scenario, to assist you with a differential diagnosis, to talk through an airway plan. It's essentially what you and I enjoyed when we worked together at North York General, which was, I'm working in the recess, you're working in the fast track. I come to you with an ECG that I'm finding challenging, or I want a second set of eyes on an X-ray, and I say, hey, Anton, what do you think about this? And you and I go elbow to elbow and have a conversation about perhaps the nuance of the case, or perhaps something that's tripping me up, or perhaps something that I've never seen before, and I'm looking to you for a second set of eyes to assist me with my next best step. So essentially, it's that ability to access a trusted colleague created in the virtual space where one doesn't exist. So our primary target audience are those physicians who are working in single coverage environments. So primarily the small suburban rural centers, but you don't have to go too far out or outside of our large city centers to find yourself on a single coverage evening or overnight shift where there is no one to ask, or perhaps in an environment where the colleague that you're working with may not be able to offer you that second set of eyes on a case. So we provide assistance with simple problems, complex problems, pediatric problems, geriatric problems, you know, cradle to the grave, 24/7. And really, we're a colleague that you can trust to help you make the next best decision for the patient in front of you.
So it's truly call a friend.
It is truly
like an actual real live call a friend.
Well, you know, one of our taglines, and it's actually on my email signature, if you'll look back in some of our email correspondence, which really is, we answer each and every call, how can I help? Our team of peers really truly embraces this idea that we're there to help. So there's no problem that's too complex, no problem that's too simple.
Fantastic. Okay, we'll talk a little bit more about how it actually works.
Sure.
In a minute, but I just want to kind of go back in time and like, what originally was your sort of motivation or the seed for this happening? And I imagine there were many, 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 many steps, and there was probably all kinds of red tape, and there was probably a lot of people involved to actually get it going. It is very impressive that you actually got this going. But what was sort of the very beginning? Like, how did it all come about in the first place?
So certainly in our province, the very beginning dates back over a decade. There was a small group of docs out of Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, led by Dr. Dan Howes. And for context, this is a receiving hospital. This is a tertiary care hospital that receives, you know, consults and transfers from rural sites, sometimes 200, 300, 400 kilometers away. And they, with a little bit of seed money and some doorbell cameras, set up what was really the inaugural peer-to-peer program in our province, which was, let's put some doorbell cameras and some resuscitation bays in our small and rural sites, and let's give those site docs in those small sites some support. Let's loop in with those docs well before they end up down the bumpy road to tertiary care, perhaps in the back of an ambulance, and assist those docs to make sure, you know, the patient is well prepared for transport, that, you know, all the sort of threats to life and limb, perhaps, or some of the procedural pieces are established before they leave those rural sites. Let's make sure that the patient on arrival to the tertiary care site is in the best shape that they can be, as prepared the best for that transport. And what they found was, not only was this excellent for patients, this was excellent for the relationships between the sending and the receiving physicians. This started to build this real collegial, high-quality, evidence-based, supportive environment where they could really assist these rural docs. And so with some championship from Dr. Howard Evans, who's our provincial emergency medicine lead, and we ultimately were able to turn our lights on for the Ontario Health Peer-to-Peer Program in late 2022.
Amazing. You know, one of the visions of EM Cases is to build community amongst the worldwide EM community. I mean, this is just such a fantastic way to build community locally or province-wide or statewide or wherever, you know, you may have a program like this. You can't really underestimate the value of building community, especially during COVID. We had rough times. There's been huge numbers of docs burning out. Building community is one of the solutions to prevent burnout and make our community better. So I love that. Have you gotten to the point yet in terms of evaluation? Do you have data on outcomes? Do you have feedback from docs? Any outcome data yet for the peer program?
We do. We keep very strict, just quantitative data. But we realize that the numbers themselves don't tell the full story. So we've done our best to capture the stories behind them, the sort of qualitative stories behind them, and have a large database now of docs that write in and say, you know, but for the peer-to-peer program, I wouldn't have been able to sleep after that, you know, particularly challenging call, or I decided to go to take a locum in a low resource setting that I otherwise wouldn't have considered because I knew I could take the peer-to-peer program in my back pocket with me and never be alone. And that emboldened, you know, a clinician to go to a setting that perhaps they would otherwise not have felt comfortable to do. I think from the Provincial Emergency Services Program at Ontario Health, part of the goal of peer-to-peer is really to help support and stabilize emergency medicine. And you don't need to look too far to realize that there's too few of us doing the practice of emergency medicine, specifically in small and rural sites. And so the efforts to sort of support that workforce to make sure that those folks have access to the collegial support that is wonderful. And I think the sort of side benefit is, we all want to feel joy in our work. We all want to feel that we're providing the best patient care we can. And certainly when you're working in austere environments, when you're alone making those decisions, that weight can further your sense of burnout, your sense of being alone, your sense of maybe not wanting to do that again. And so I think that's really the outcome, you know, the anecdotal letters and tweets and emails that we get to say, thank you so much, but for the fact this program, I wouldn't be still doing this type of medicine. So that's been an enormous high for us. Personally, I think I can speak on behalf of the peers. I think this has been some of the most rewarding and best work I've ever done.
Amazing. I kind of want to do both now. Like, can I, what's the process for becoming a peer?
Yeah, exactly.
I want to be able to call and take the call, which brings up, how does someone call? I mean, for our Ontario listeners that work in rural and smaller locations where they're single coverage, how can they contact a peer? And then for people who want to become peers, how does that process work?
So in Ontario, we have one number to call. So if you need to reach a consultant, whether that be a trauma team, a neurosurgical team, we have a one number to call through our provincial answering service critical. Through that same service, you simply say, I would like to be connected to an ED peer. You can do that with a patient in front of you. You can do that prior to the patient's arrival. Maybe you want some advice because something's coming in via EMS and you want a peer on the line to help you prepare. You can call 2 hours after your shift is over because you're ruminating on a case and wondering if you should call that patient back. So we're available 24/7. You don't need a patient or a health card or a demographic in front of you. You simply ask for a peer. Our time to help is usually on order of two rings. So less than 20 seconds and you'll be connected with one of our peers. We are on duty for the program.
It's not like calling your local hospital locating.
No, there's no music. Muzak. No Muzak.
Excellent. So that's the process of accessing the peer program when you need it, which is fantastic for anyone who works in Ontario in emergency departments. How about if you want to become a peer? How does that work?
So we had a call for applications in 2022. We had a tsunami of applications, which was wonderful. And we weeded through some of the most exceptional applicants that I've ever seen in my life with the search criteria of clinicians who had 10, 15 years of experience, who had worked in rural environments, who'd walked the walk of rural medicine. We want to make sure that someone has been appropriately humbled working in austere environments and understands that, you know, an MR or a CT is sometimes 200 kilometers away and you need to make a different decision, even if the guidelines say that, you know, X intervention is the next step.
Let's take a little break to hear from one of our sponsors, Metricaid, the experts in complex physician scheduling since 2012. Metricaid's expert schedulers are their secret sauce. These people truly understand the complexities of physician scheduling. They empower us by providing the tools we need to manage our teams efficiently. At the same time, they give physicians more freedom to share their workflow preferences, so schedules aren't just fair, they're actually workable. Metricaid's system is built to make your schedule work for you. They take the stress out of shift planning so that you can focus on what matters most. Go to metricaid.com/emcases to learn more about how smarter scheduling can work for you. That's metricaid, one word, .com/emcases. Any advice for others starting their own similar program in other provinces or states or countries?
I think keep the mission in mind. The mission is to deliver high quality care to the patients you serve. And how you do that is with relationships. So it's relationships with the site clinician and their patient. And then just as I remember when I was a resident working with mums and babes, and we always said, you got to feed the mum so the mum can feed the babe. If that's the sort of paradigm you're thinking of. And I think what we really understand is that if we can support that site clinician, whether they're in a rural or remote environment, they have access to some labs, no labs, some diagnostics, no diagnostics. If we can support that site physician to make the next best choice, that patient's going to benefit enormously. The system will benefit enormously as we prepare patients better for potential transport or, you know, we intervene or ask open-ended questions and really support that clinician. So I think that's really needs to be the culture of any program that set up this. This is a flat hierarchy of help, if you will. This is not expert to learner. This is peer to peer. This is compassionate, humble care. And so I think creating a program where everyone on the program will answer every call, how can I help, and truly mean it and find joy in providing, you know, that encouragement, that empowerment. And I think it's a bilateral respect that is established with the relationships. And so I think it's really a culture to establish a peer-to-peer program. It's a culture of a flat hierarchy of help. It's a humble, compassionate system that's based on both wanting the best outcome for the patient in front of you.
And again, just the value it brings not only to patients, but to the physicians involved in supporting each other. To me, that is one really great way of ensuring a fun, engaging, meaningful career in emergency medicine and continuing to feel that way and not burning out. So that's just wonderful. What do you see in the future of the peer-to-peer program?
We really see ourselves leading a culture change, I hope, in emergency medicine, that it's okay to ask for help. Not only is it okay to ask for help, it might actually be fun and you might actually learn something and you're going to make some relationships that you perhaps otherwise wouldn't have. So you and I sort of graduated in and around the same time, but I remember thinking on July 1st of my, you know, graduation years over 20 years ago now, that you were supposed to know everything. You were done asking questions. You were done being preceptored. You were out on your own. And what you know is that you don't know what you don't know. And the more you ask questions, the more rewarding your practice becomes, the more interesting each patient becomes, the more wise and skilled you become as you move forward in this discipline. And so I think we really see ourselves relationship building, continuing the rollout. I think there are still pockets of our province in particular that still don't know we exist. And so we are doing lots to embed ourselves in the undergraduate curriculums. So too can we teach our residents that it's okay to ask for help, that we still ask for help even 20 years on in our career. And that if you are working alone or in an environment where, you know, there is no one to ask a question, that peer-to-peer is there. And you're going to start making wonderful relationships with the peer on the other end of the line and be able to make that next best decision, create that airtight differential diagnosis and management plan.
I can tell you that as someone who's asked more than 10,000 hours worth of questions on EM cases to other colleagues and experts, I can tell you that there is great value in asking colleagues questions. If you believe in the 10,000 hour rule, I have spent more than 10,000 hours asking questions in emergency medicine. So.
It's amazing. Amazing.
So yeah, and I would love to continue
asking
questions.
And I bet you would still say, I don't have mastery yet.
Oh, not even close.
Not even close. And how wonderful that is. How wonderful
that is.
Truly
lifelong learning, and it's what keeps me going for sure.
Yep.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Dr. Booth. Anyone who has further interest in the peer-to-peer program, please feel free to contact Dr. Booth. We'll have an email address in the show notes for those interested in developing their own program in their own location, wherever they work. So thanks so much, Dr. Booth.
Thank you so much.
If you're a regular EM Cases listener and you haven't yet donated to EM Cases like many of your colleagues, we'd really appreciate your contribution to help ensure that EM Cases continues to provide you with high-quality EM education and to help it grow. The exciting news is that, thanks in part to your generous donations, we've hired two deputy directors at EM Cases who will be starting in 2026. We're thrilled to tell you who they are as well. Dr. Katie Lynn is an EM doc, transport doc, and stroke doc in Calgary, who's a well-known all-star educator who you've probably heard on EM Cases before or you've seen at the EM Cases Summit speak. She'll be producing and hosting some of the podcasts, and I'm totally psyched to have some fresh ideas and a new voice mixed in to the EM Cases learning system. And then to help us make the website as good as it can possibly be for you, the incredible Sarah Braid is an EM doc in Toronto who's been writing lots of excellent show notes for EM Cases over the past couple of years. She'll be making the website even better with better show notes, videos, and Quiz Vault. So please head over to the EM Cases website and hit the donation button in the top right corner of your laptop or at the bottom of your screen on your phone to quickly and easily make a donation and support our dedicated EM Cases team. All right, until next time, take it easy.